Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And today we start a two-part series about a very important company in technology, but it's one that I would say the average person doesn't really know a lot about.
Right, sure. I mean, you know, and it's only important if you've ever used a computer or a car or
a mobile phone.
Right.
Or, yeah, it's only if you've ever used any electronics ever is this company actually important. So if you're the Luddite who hasn't, first of all, how are you getting this podcast? And second of all, okay. But yeah, we're talking about Fairchild Semiconductor. And you may have heard of this company. It actually, like I said, it's very important in the development of technology as we have it today. I mean, it's the work that they did laid the foundation for what makes the technology we use today possible.
One of their inventions in what was it, 1958 or so, is the basic technology that we still use today.
Right. It's what allowed miniaturization, right? I mean, some of the earlier work had already been done before Fairchild became a thing, or Fairchild Semiconductor, I should say. But let's start at the beginning. So first of all, I guess we should talk a little bit about...
So what is a semiconductor?
That's a good question to ask, because we're going to be talking about them a lot. So a semiconductor is kind of, I mean, if you think of the word, it kind of makes sense. A semiconductor is some sort of material that, under certain circumstances, acts as a conductor, as in it conducts electricity.
And in others, it does not.
Yeah, it acts more like an insulator. It does not conduct electricity. Now, in the case of electronics, we're usually talking about something that has been engineered so that certain parts of it conduct electricity effectively, other parts insulate, again, allow for this thing like transistors. Transistors are essentially electron gates.
So that's where you get that on-off switch, that 1-0 sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. This is what allows us to control the flow of electrons through a circuit so that we can have various outcomes. So, for example, with a microprocessor, where you're using something in a computer or a mobile handset, this is what allows that those logical functions to take place. And we use things called logic gates. Logic gates are essentially rules that say when you get this kind of input, you will create this kind of output.
Yeah. Right.
So let's say here's a really simple example showing the 1-0 concept. Let's say you have two light switches. All right. And you have one light bulb. And if you flip a light switch to the up position, that's technically the number one, let's say. So let's say you flip both light switches up to the number one position and the light bulb comes on. So that would be 1-1-1. Everything is on. If you switch both light switches to the off position, that would be 0. The light bulb goes off. That's 0-0-0. Now let's say you switch the first light switch on, second light switch off, and the light bulb comes on. That's 1-0-1. You do first light switch down, second light switch up, that's 0-1, and then the light bulb comes on, that's another 1. So that would be an example of a gate. And you could have all different kinds of combinations with that particular gate. It could be that when both switches are down, the light's on, but in any other combination, it's off. That's all different types of logic gates. So we create these logic gates to create the different scenarios necessary to process data. And this data is just in the form of electrons. Now, what I explained to you might sound like sorcery, but no, seriously, this is the basis of electronics and computers. And the fact that we're able to miniaturize these elements to teeny, teeny, tiny amounts, we're talking the nanoscale these days, is what allows us to have the computers and mobile devices that we use today. Otherwise, we would still be depending upon massive, massive pieces of electronic equipment.
Right, right. You would be tethered to a room rather than a cell phone.
Yeah, or
you
a building.
Send a tweet, sure.
Yeah, because we're talking back in those days, you know, we're just talking circuits, and circuits are just pathways for electricity. That's really what a basic circuit is. Now, in the old days, you made these pathways out of physical wires and other components that were huge, like vacuum tubes. I mean, these are big, big things. It was only after the transistor was invented that we started to see the possibility of moving away from that. And even those earliest transistors weren't integrated circuits.
Oh, they were, right. They were pretty bulky.
Yeah.
They were frequently called Mesa transistors because they slightly resembled Mesa settlements in the desert. Because they were big and blocky and weird looking. And
Yeah. The very first one is practically enormous. I mean, you can see pictures of it in things like the Computer History Museum, they have a replica. But anyway, one of the three inventors, one of the three people we credit with inventing the transistor, was William Bradford Shockley. And he and John Bardeen and Walter H. Brattain.
We were working at Bell Telephone.
Yeah, Bell Telephone Labs. So they were over at Bell Labs, and they created that first semiconductor back in 1947. Now, in 1954, Shockley left Bell Labs to found his own semiconductor factory called Shockley Semiconductors. And he hired up all these smart engineers and scientists. He said, these are the people that are going to really push this as an industry. I see the potential here. We need to really grab the best and brightest.
And he knew a lot about that at the time. In 1956, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics.
No, he was one of the, I believe he and a couple of others were credited with it. But yes, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work in creating transistors. Yeah, smart guy. However, in 1956, eight of the 12 brilliant guys that he hired said, you know,
we're not really a fan of your practices or management style, or
you're kind of a jerk.
Your face.
Yeah. Okay. So in the interest of full disclosure, Shockley, if you ever look him up, held some incredibly controversial and really not nice views.
I've heard him compared to a slightly less polite Howard Hughes.
Yeah. If you're wondering what we're talking about, look up William Bradford Shockley. It's not really germane to this discussion, so we're not going to cover it.
Right.
Maybe we'll do an episode about him some other time, but at any rate.
So it was important that he hired these 12 people, and was concentrating them on trying to figure out ways of using, germanium and silicon.
Right. Yes. Because those were the materials that seemed to be the most promising for semiconductors.
Right.
And, these eight of the 12 decided to leave. And of course, Shockley being the understated fellow that he is, labeled them the traitorous eight.
Yes, which I love.
You broke my heart, Fredo! So, 1957, these eight engineers, and you're going to recognize at least one of these names, guys, I'm pretty sure. I'll leave the one that you'll recognize most likely last. There's C. Sheldon Roberts, Eugene Kleiner, Robert N. Noyce, I'm sure some of you recognize that name, Victor H. Grinch, Julius Blank, Gene A. Herney, and J.T. Last. The last one is Gordon E. Moore.
A.K.A. that guy who came up with Moore's Law.
Yeah, this is the guy who created Moore's Law, which was, of course, an observation. He had observed that there was this tendency for manufacturing companies to cram twice as many components onto a square-inch silicon chip every year or so. Now, we've since reinterpreted that to mean that every 2 years or so, computers get twice as powerful as they used to be. Anyway, he was one of the founding members. These guys, they decided to leave, and they decided they wanted to found their own company. And they approached a company called Fairchild Camera and Instrument Corporation, which was located out of New York.
And they were looking to get into superconductors at the time, semiconductors at the time.
Right, exactly.
Superconductors are a different thing.
Right, right. But semiconductors, yes. By the way, people, we're recording this in a very warm room. So there's going to be some verbal stumbles on the part of both of us. And maybe even Tyler, who is sitting in for Noel today. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Tyler.
Tyler's waving, which is great for radio. So, at any rate, they went to Fairchild Camera and Instrument Corporation and said, "Hey guys, I hear that you are looking at getting into the semiconductor business. We are very knowledgeable about semiconductors. How about we get together and work on this?" And Fairchild said, maybe. And so they kind of drew up an agreement. And in that agreement, each of the engineers put $500 of their own money toward this as a stake in the venture. And then Fairchild threw in another $1.5 million. So, you know, equal parts all around, right?
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, it started at, Fairchild had the option to outright buy the company within 8 years of it starting. And
yeah,
so,
that was one of the conditions of that.
Yeah. You got to read the fine print, guys. No, so in October of 1957, Fairchild Semiconductor becomes a real thing.
And it was just the third company that existed in Silicon Valley. Of course, it wasn't called Silicon Valley at the time. It was called Santa Clara Valley to anyone who, you know, happened to live there.
Yeah, if you're wondering what the first one was, that's Hewlett-Packard. That's technically the first company in Silicon Valley. Unlike the others, Fairchild didn't start in a garage. One of the few things to set it apart from every other company that ever started in Silicon Valley. They bucked the trend. Of course, at that point, it's not a trend, I guess.
Right.
Unless you're the Braves, in which case 3 games in a row is a winning streak. All right, so.
I'm sure that was a harsh diss for someone who knows something about baseball.
Well, they've got the best record in baseball right now, so it's not really a diss. Okay, so moving on. Semiconductors. What happens with making one? How are they made? So this is a little different from the way they were doing it in the earliest days at Fairchild. But in general, what you have to start with is pure silicon. It's very important that it's as pure as possible. You wanted to get it as close to 100% pure as you possibly can, because you are going to be messing with this stuff in the future. But you know, it's really
and the ways
precise.
In which you mess with it are the ways in which it works.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So when you start with a good pure base, that.
Yeah, that makes it possible. Otherwise, your chips are not going to work. You're going to end up with a huge waste of resources.
So you grow these pure silicon crystals into kind of cylinders.
Yeah. The way it works is you got this big old vat of liquid silicon, and then you dip the pure crystal in. It makes the rest of the liquid crystallize
around it
into one crystal. It's like one solid crystal,
which is
shape.
A really fascinating process, by the way.
Yeah, and then
it's really fun to watch.
You draw it out, and you've got this big old cylindrical ingot, is what they call them. And then you use a saw, usually controlled these days by a robot, but it's a saw that cuts the cylinder into wafers or wafers, if you prefer, you know, Monty Python approach. So it's wafer thin, and you cut a series of wafers through this ingot. Each wafer is about 0.75 millimeters thick and just under 12 inches in diameter, so about 300 millimeters. And you cut once you've cut that, then you're ready to start the diffusion and etching process. So let's talk about what's going on. Well, actually, first you have to polish it. I should say, because you want it to be
really smooth to start out with.
Yeah, you want it to be as uniform as possible, because you're going to be, again, making very tiny changes to it, particularly these days. Now, again, back in the Fairchild days, you're talking about elements that were on the micro scale. Now we're on the nano scale, but we'll talk more about why that's important in the next episode. So essentially what you're doing is you're using chemicals to give certain properties to the semiconductor and then cut away parts that you don't want. So there are two different types of semiconductor material. There's N-type and there's P-type, which essentially stands for negative and positive. The negative types have extra electrons that they can give up. The positive types have holes, electron holes, that can accept electrons. This is what allows electricity to flow through semiconductor material. So you're actually introducing small amounts of impurities. It's called doping. And in this case, it's not a bad thing. So you're not going to get thrown out of the Olympics for it. You probably won't go into the Olympics either. But anyway, so you're doing this doping process, and it's imagine that you add in a layer of this special stuff that dopes your wafer, like N-type. We'll just say N-type. And then you coat certain parts of the wafer with a chemical that's going to protect that layer. Then you use a different chemical to etch away anything that was not coated. So only the coated stuff remains whole.
Creating a certain pattern on the chip.
Right.
The wafer surface, rather.
Exactly. Then you do another coating. Maybe now it's a P coating. And again, you coat it again with... You're like 12. It's like Chris Paulette. She's just giggling and looking at me. Yes, it's a P coating. The letter P. And then you coat that with an oxide again. You use the chemicals to etch away all the non-relevant parts. You do this many, many, many times in order for you to make a final semiconductor chip of whatever it is that you were building. And keep in mind, this could be lots of different stuff. Semiconductor material is used in more than just microprocessors. It's used in a lot of other basic pieces of electronics. But we mostly think of it as microprocessors because that's one of those things that I think everyone has some familiarity with.
Right, sure.
So, the process is done several times in order to get exactly what it is you want. And then once that's done, then it can go into the next level of processing, which usually involves putting in some connectors so that it can connect to whatever it is that you're going to be using.
To whatever else here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you finish it off with whatever covers need to be placed on it. Then it gets packaged and sent off to wherever it needs to go. So that's your basic step from beginning to end. And so one thing that the Fairchild folks had come up with was this idea of double diffusion. Now, that is the process I was talking about of introducing those impurities, that doping process. And the way that they were doing it was cutting down on the processing time that they would need to do. Back in the early days, if you wanted to make a transistor, you essentially had to do it piece by piece. You would get a wafer and you would make one transistor and you'd end up having that all cut out and done. Then you would go back to the wafer and make the next one. They found a way where they could process this and make several transistors out of an entire wafer all at once. So it really cut down on the amount of time it took to produce transistors, which in turn brought the price down. This is what Gordon Moore was talking about when he made that observation. He said, we're making improvements in manufacturing, which is making it possible for us to reduce the price of components, which is making it possible to build bigger components. So really, when he made that observation, it wasn't anything necessarily about computer power or electronics power. It was more about the economics.
It was just about the actual, right.
Yeah.
The actual physical pieces and...
Yeah. It was just...
The price point.
Ultimately, yeah, it all comes down to money, which is, cheerful. Hey, that being said, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. and you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
All right, so we're back. Let's talk about the actual history of Fairchild. So it was founded in 1957.
6 months later, it was profitable.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, brand new company, unproven, other than the fact that they knew they had some of the smartest guys in the industry.
Sure, sure.
Still.
And also, I mean, they made their first sale was to IBM for an order of 100 transistors priced at $150 a pop.
Right. And in 1958, that was approximately $5 million.
It was a bunch.
That. Yeah, it was a bunch.
It was a bunch of dollars.
$150 for 100 transistors. Well, $150 per transistor for 100 transistors, all to IBM. That's a good first client to have.
Yeah, sure. Not too bad. My favorite part about this story is that when they had to ship them, Jay Last just ran out to a local supermarket and picked up a used Brillo carton. Brillo being that brand of scrubby sponges.
Right. Yeah, they're sponges that have some steel wool and soap in them.
Yeah. And he just picked up a used carton and they were just like, oh, this is good for transistors, and plopped them in and sent them off.
Yeah. Keeping in mind that, you know, these days we have very specific packaging for all this kind of
crazy
stuff.
Crazy Faraday cages built in and all sorts of.
And like plastic that you will never ever open without the use of some sort of chainsaw. Yeah. I like this though. It adds a little kind of dash of whimsy to the story. And that same year, one of the engineers, Robert Noyce, developed the monolithic integrated circuit. Now, this is the invention you were talking about earlier in the show, Lauren, the one that truly defines the way we use computers and electronics, what makes them what they are, because it's what allowed an entire circuit to be put upon a single chip of silicon. Before, it was that you would create different components and then wire them all together, which meant that you were limited by
size.
You wouldn't be able to get too small. But this suddenly created the possibility of miniaturization on a level that they had never had before. However, it did mean that there weren't that many customers who needed this yet, because there just wasn't a market there.
Right.
So it was a huge development, and it was phenomenal and really important in computers and electronics. But at the time, everyone's like, well, that's cool, but
what does it do?
I don't
Why
need
do we
that?
Use
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. But we'll understand. There's an interesting first really good application for it coming up. So he was not the only person to work on the integrated circuit and come up with this. There was a separate group that came up with it independently.
Led by Jack Kilby over at Texas Instruments. And the story of that one goes that Jack had only been with Texas Instruments for a couple of months and was left alone, therefore, at the offices during a vacation time when everyone else had off.
Right.
And just sitting around came up with this, with a very similar idea for how to add layers to a wafer chip.
Right.
Before starting to etch out the chemical process. And I think the chemical process is what Noyce really came up with. But yeah, anyway, you know, they both applied for patents, both companies. And
right.
Fairchild would wind up winning that one really hard, partially because Noyce had sort of expanded upon the same concept filed a much more detailed patent.
Right. But, so if you've listened to our episodes on Texas Instruments, you've probably heard our story there where we talked about the integrated circuit. It's interesting and not unusual to see two different people in two different companies, not necessarily having any connection with one another, independently come up with the same thing. We've seen this happen again and again, and sometimes it just kind of indicates that the time was right.
Right.
Like enough of the groundwork had been laid that someone was going to come up with it. And when you've got that many brilliant people working on it, surely it shouldn't come as a surprise that more than one person realized how it was going to work. In this case, we give the credit largely to Noyce, or at least he got the patent for it. In 1959, Gene Herney created the first planar transistor. Now, it's kind of complicated to talk about what exactly the planar transistor is, but in general, the earlier transistors had exposed junctions, which made them less efficient when they were processing electricity, when they were doing whatever it was they were supposed to be doing in that particular transistor. There was a lot of leakage, which meant that not all the electrons were going where you wanted them to go, and you had a lot of wasted power in that case. The planar approach meant that, and planar is P-L-A-N-A-R.
Which was, at least for a long time, I'm not sure if it still is, was a proprietary word owned by Fairchild.
Interesting.
That they made a good couple million bucks on licensing for.
Wow, I did not know that. I didn't see that in my research. Well, at any rate, according to what I read, the main reason they called it that was because it ended up having these protective layers that were on top of these transistors. And the conventional wisdom at the time was that you needed to remove those at the end of processing in order for this transistor to work. There were a lot of engineers who were of the opinion that if you were to leave those layers in place, either the transistor wouldn't work properly, it would be less efficient, or it just was a wasteful idea. That was something that Herney said, no, let's try this.
Mm-hmm.
And created a transistor using this approach where those layers were left in place, and it actually created a much more efficient transistor. And the reason I've seen of why it was called planar is because the transistor itself was flat because those layers had not been removed. There are other descriptions that say that the reason why it's called that is because all the elements are within the same plane of each other. Knowledge may vary, you know. The wacky thing about history is that different people define it in different ways, and we just have to go with whatever one we like most. So then that takes us up to 1961, and that's when Fairchild Semiconductor got that patent on the monolithic integrated circuit. When I hear monolithic integrated circuit, I just imagine it must have been enormous. That's a monolithic integrated, yes.
Like the thing out of 2001?
Right, yes, yeah. Exactly. That's mm-hmm. the second biggest integrated circuit I've ever seen. Anyway, the first integrated circuit that was commercially available from Fairchild was the resistor transistor logic product, also known as RTL. So you're going to hear us talk about a lot of these terms. We're not going to go into a lot of detail because every single one of these gets really, really technical. But at any rate, this is what was leading to true miniaturization, allowing these computers and electronics to come in those smaller form factors. Now, those first integrated circuits were $120 per chip. It's pretty expensive. And again, there weren't that many customers out there that had need for it, except for one big one. So 1961, what industry really had to conserve on how much space their stuff took up?
Could that be the space industry?
It could be. You know, it's so ironic that there's nothing out there but space. And yet they needed to conserve space.
Can you guys hear me shaking my head at him?
So yeah, obviously when you're designing a spacecraft, some sort of space capsule, every single tiny amount of space
every
is important.
Every ounce and every, right.
Yeah, you gotta have enough room for, if it's a manned spacecraft, you have to have enough room for the astronauts to move around and do whatever it is they need to do. And so conserving that was of the highest level of importance. So the space industry, NASA, really relied heavily on Fairchild Semiconductor in those early days. In fact, some of the components that Fairchild would make would be used in the Apollo program for the guidance systems. Very important stuff. In 1962, Fairchild opened up a production facility in Maine.
South Portland, specifically.
Yep, South Portland. That would become important. That's, spoiler alert, this will come in play in the second part of our series. That's where the headquarters are now.
Right.
South Portland, Maine. But that facility was opened in 62, and the transistors produced there were intended mostly for radios and oscilloscopes and a few other instruments, you know, electronic instruments. In 63, they produced the resistor transistor logic dual gate device, the RTL dual gate device, the first to incorporate buried layer isolation technology, which are the planar resistors. This was the first time they had actually incorporated that approach that Noyce and Herney had pioneered, and now this was actually going into a product.
Yeah, right.
So they were, you know, you could think of those earlier discoveries. They obviously took a couple of years to get worked into the manufacturing process.
Right, right. And those went up with Apollo, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. So these are the ones that the Apollo program would rely on heavily for multiple systems, mainly guidance. In 64, they created the NPN planar power transistor. That was kind of like, you can imagine it like a sandwich, all right? So the top piece of bread on your sandwich is really negative. It's just a negative piece of bread. This is the N-type silicon. Then you would have the delicious center of your sandwich, which in my case would probably be peanut butter and jelly because I'm, you know, a man of sophistication. That would be P-type, so that's very positive. Silicon. Then the bottom layer bread, once again, from that same negative loaf that you received earlier. It's the other N-type. And it used thin film resistors. This is important because previous versions of integrated circuits actually used little tiny metal connectors to connect the various layers.
Right, right. Those were the film of this was thin enough that it would let the electrons just pass through it directly rather than needing those.
Yeah, those connectors. Exactly. It made it simpler to produce these types of transistors. And again, according to Moore's law, we would find these developments making it more efficient, cheaper to produce. That's what allowed us to create more complex electronics using these components and to make the components themselves more complex.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. based on independent third-party data. Number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
So 65, that's when Fairchild produces the operational amplifier, or op-amp. So that's essentially what it sounds like. An amplifier amplifies something. It makes something bigger. In this case, it's voltage. So what it would do is take the incoming voltage and amplify the potential difference from the input terminals significantly, remembering that voltage is a measurement of the difference in electric potential.
Right. 1965 was also the year in which Moore actually published that article, eloquently titled Cramming More Components Onto Integrated Circuits, in which Moore's observation or law was laid out.
Yep. And boy, Moore's law, that's one of those things that even today you have people saying, any day now is going to be the last day for Moore's law. And the engineers say, I will take you up on that challenge. And so, 66. Let's move on. Let's keep going. Because, you know, Fairchild kept going, so we will too. 66, they created the first standard transistor-transistor logic, or TTL product, which was a quad two input negated AND gate, or NAND, N-A-N-D. So that's a logic gate that creates a false output only if all inputs are true. So in binary terms, if you put in two ones, you get a zero. Any other input combination results in a 1. So if you get two zeros, it comes out as a 1. 1, 1 and 1, 0 comes out as a 1. 1, 0, 1, 1 comes out as 1. I know this gets confusing, but you have to, you do essentially think, like with two switches, you have four potential combinations, even though you would mostly think, well, one's off and one's on. Yeah, but it's important to designate that off, on, and on, off are different in the sense of binary. Me getting on my binary soapbox, which only has two sides. It's not really a box, I guess. All right, so 1967, Fairchild introduces the new op-amp with temperature compensation and metal oxide silicon capacitor, or MOS, M-O-S, metal oxide silicon. We're getting into a lot of initialisms and some acronyms.
Thank you, Twitter listener, name I don't have right now.
In front of us, yes, who corrected us.
Pointing that out, yes.
Yeah, I do that all the time,
Jonathan's
too.
Being snarky, but
yeah,
I actually really appreciate it.
No, I really do, too. I am that guy. I'm the guy who makes those corrections, so I cannot criticize others for doing the same to me, because I do that to other people. But yes, in 68, Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce left the company. They leave Fairchild. Now, see, the Fairchild camera and instruments, they were kind of, while Fairchild Semiconductor was part of this company, the people over at Fairchild Camera and Instruments were sometimes a little handsy when it came to the management style. Like they would sit there and override certain things that the engineers thought were really important. And so the founders, sometimes referred to as Fairchildren, became less enchanted with the company they had helped create. And one by one, or sometimes sometimes more than one by one, they left to go and either work for someone else or to found their own companies.
Right. In this case, Moore and Noyce left to found something called Intel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Might have heard of it.
Little company called Intel. So they, which is, you know, you sit there and you think about, this is a pretty interesting progression. First, they worked for Shockley, one of the inventors of the transistor. Then they went on to found Fairchild Semiconductor, and now they're leaving again to found Intel. We'll talk about some of the other companies that were founded by Fairchildren as well. That'll come into play later on. Meanwhile, Fairchild Semiconductor hired away a guy named C. Lester Hogan, who was formerly of Motorola's semiconductor business, to become the head of Fairchild Semiconductor. And Hogan did something that made him extremely unpopular at Motorola and very popular at Fairchild Camera, but not necessarily so much at Fairchild Semiconductor. He decided to cannibalize his old division at Motorola, and he brought on lots and lots of managers. Some would say around 100 managers from Motorola, but he also brought along 7 executives to become the new management of Fairchild Semiconductor. They essentially wiped out the existing management of Fairchild and replaced them.
Right, right.
Now, those 7 executives from Motorola had their own nickname. You had the Traitorous 8, who made up the original Fairchild Semiconductor group. The 7 executives were called Hogan's Heroes.
Hogan's Heroes. That's right. I did read about that.
And they went on to star in a great television series.
I don't think that's true.
No?
No. But Motorola did sue Fairchild for damages due to all of this.
Yeah.
I think the final outcome of that case was that the court said, like, well, it didn't help them that much if they had any wrongdoing.
Yeah, that was like the biggest backhanded win of all time, right? Or it's very similar to something that happened in the Apple-Samsung patent disputes. A judge ended up looking at this case that Motorola brought against Fairchild, saying that Fairchild had essentially completely butchered Motorola's semiconductor business. They kind of doomed it by taking all the talent.
And furthermore, had like stolen some trade secrets by lieu of
exactly
these human people.
Yeah,
who
were developing the products of Motorola had in their heads the information that was important to Motorola's success, and these were trade secrets, and therefore Fairchild had stolen trade secrets in this process. And initially, there was a 10% drop in stock price at Motorola and a 19% increase at Fairchild, but this lawsuit took years to play out, right? And by the end of it, the judge said, you know, I'm looking at Fairchild's numbers, and this has not done them any good at all, so I can't see how you can say that that Fairchild was doing this in order to get an advantage, because if that's what their intent was, it sure hasn't played out that way. And Fairchild was like,
ouch.
You?
Yeah.
Ow. Yeah, that was a huge slap in the face for both companies at the same time. Justice. 1969, Fairchild builds a semiconductor plant on Navajo Reservation territory in Shiprock, New Mexico.
Will become important later.
Yeah, it's a tough story. So 1973, Fairchild tries out a new technique creating integrated circuit transistors. It's called isoplanar 2. And that actually lets them reduce the size of transistors by about 70% while keeping the power consumption at the same, more or less the same level. That's also the year when we actually got that judgment against Motorola. 1974 was when Hogan was dismissed as president of Fairchild. He remained the vice chairman at the time, and the company starts to have rounds of layoffs. This was a point where they started talking about Fairchild Semiconductor having a real problem with management and mismanagement of the company. And some of that was due to the executives. Some of it was due to the board of directors or Fairchild Camera, to be perfectly blunt. So Hogan, who had been this sort of golden child and, you know, the center of this huge debate for several years, is now on the outs. He's no longer president. 1975 was when a really controversial thing happened back at that plant that was on Navajo Reservation territory.
Mm-hmm. There was an armed protest there.
Yeah. 20 Navajo protesters, armed Navajo protesters from the American Indian Movement, took the plant by force, demanding better working conditions. And they also had demands that didn't have anything to do with Fairchild Semiconductor. It was more like...
It wasn't about the plant. It was just a general plea to to really the United States.
Right. Yeah. It was to bring attention to the state of affairs that Native Americans were living under in reservations across the United States. It's saying we want attention brought. We want better living conditions. So really they were using the plant as sort of their platform to get this attention. They held it for 8 days under armed force and eventually gave themselves up peacefully. Fairchild's response once this was over was to shut down that plant entirely, and they just left. It's now an abandoned building, or at least it was the last I saw from the last report I read, which I think was written in 2008 or 2009. So it could be something different now. But, the story is pretty grim because while I think everyone at Fairchild had maybe not the most honorable of intentions, but you know, they wanted to build this facility here partially because they could get really cheap labor, but it would mean that they could help this community. It seemed to me like they had that interest at heart, that they really did want to take it, not just take advantage of people, but to help a community.
Sure. Although it was a very important protest to go on. I mean,
yeah. I mean, this was, you could argue about whether or not it was done in the best way, but it was certainly, this was an era in the United States
history.
As part
of that human rights movement that was transitioning from the 1960s on.
Yeah.
It was critical for all of that. Although, right, yeah.
Yeah.
You can argue about whether or not it was the
right way to go, but yeah.
But at a certain point when people are desperate.
Yeah. 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 There was a point where they were feeling like there was no one listening, and this was a way to make the world listen. So that kind of wraps up our first episode, this pivotal moment when Fairchild has this very public, very violent or potentially violent moment. And they're really in a moment, the company itself is in this sort of chaotic transition where they've undergone changes in their executive leadership. We'll talk more about what happened in the years since 1975 in our next episode. Guys, if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, whether it's a company, it's a specific kind of technology, maybe it's just a trend in technology, let us know. Send us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. You'll find our handle is TechStuffHSW, and Lauren and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.